You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
And together we're agitating for change in Northern BC. In this episode, which we've entitled Food is Always Political, we've invited Dr. Daniel Sims to help us understand governance and food justice from a BC First Nations perspective. Daniel is an associate professor at the University of Northern British Columbia and a member of the Tsay Keh Dene First Nation near Prince George. The percentage of Indigenous population in BC varies by region, but in the North Coast region alone, over 60% of people identify as First Nations. We felt it was important to understand the foodways of people who have lived in this part of the country for over 6,000 years. We wanted to know what changed when settlers arrived and colonized the area, but most importantly, we asked Daniel how his nation responded to those changes and how their foodways have evolved. Time to check the pot and see what's cooking. One creature that's considered iconically Canadian on our landscape is the moose. Moose are really big, strong, and they've adapted to thrive in our diverse and harsh climates. This adaptability reflects a certain perseverance that's become accepted as necessary if you want to survive in northern Canada. This symbolism is also supported by the moose's historically key role in northern BC cultures, particularly among the Indigenous. The cow moose, for instance, is protected by law in hunting season. Most hunters automatically share what they harvest each fall, making a moose a symbol of collective feasting. And when you're not hunting and you encounter a moose, you give it space, partly as the honored symbol it represents, and partly because moose are not good at sharing space. When someone says food is always political, they mean that eating is never a simple act of survival. Producing, distributing, and eating food are deeply woven into the power dynamics, social structures, identity, laws, and economic systems of a people at personal, local, national, and global levels. Like the moose, foodways are complex, and they deserve a few moments of reflection and acknowledgement. Would you begin by giving us a sense of your particular nation's foodways historically? So, for instance, what did they eat and how did they harvest and prepare what they ate?
I'm from Tsay Keh Dene, which is a First Nation on the northern end of Williston Lake Reservoir, and it's related to Kwadacha and McLeod Lake. But talking about the foodways in particular, one of the interesting aspects being in BC is that our traditional territory, a lot of it is north of the Arctic-Pacific Divide. So we traditionally didn't have a lot of salmon as part of our traditional foodways, which is somewhat unusual in British Columbia. And a lot of First Nations do have salmon as kind of the main protein source. Because we didn't have salmon in that way, the main protein source for the nation would be ungulates like moose, elk, potentially deer or caribou. But moose certainly, I would say, is the animal that people talk about the most with regards to protein. And then because we are north of the Arctic Pacific Divide, when it came to agriculture and horticulture, those were limited by the very climate itself. So one of the things I ran into when I was doing my PhD research is that a huge part of our traditional territory is actually north of the semi-discontinuous permafrost zone, which is often used to define what is circumpolar. But it means that the ground freezes, but then thaws. So it's not a permanent permafrost, but it is one that is semi-permanent for what that means. So when it came to harvesting plants or encouraging their growth, certainly encouraging their growth was quite common, but a lot of the harvesting would have been what was already there or what had been encouraged to grow. But you wouldn't necessarily see people growing corn or beans or squash like you might in other parts of Canada. And agriculture in many ways was limited because of the environment itself.
You still use the term agriculture and horticulture and talked about foods being encouraged to grow. And I wonder about the colonial way of thinking and what was seen or not seen by settlers when they came. Often there's that sense of Indigenous foodways are mostly hunter-gatherer. So even though it was the more northern climate there, what was the ways of encouraging to grow and that interaction between people and their natural environment that perhaps is either not seen or consciously erased today?
I would say one of the biggest issues when it came to agriculture and contact was that a lot of Europeans are looking for agriculture that is very similar to what was happening in Europe. So this would be, you know, a big open field, a monoculture, maybe you're rotating crops. And so often when that wasn't seen in other parts of the world, particularly if monocultures weren't present, it was deemed not to be proper agriculture in that sense. And then with regards to horticulture, just completely overlooking the fact that people were maintaining and encouraging the growth of like a berry patch or a certain food plant in a particular area, not necessarily again having an acre where they're plowing and they're seeding and they're harvesting kind of like you would in Europe, but still encouraging their growth. And there recently was a study with the Gixan that looked at some of the agricultural or horticultural practices regarding nuts.
As the colonial system contact happened, did everything change? And what were the purpose of those changes that really affected the nation's foodways directly?
Yeah, I mean, one of the benefits of being kind of in the north, the southern part of the north, albeit, but being in the north, was that the changes weren't necessarily as dramatic as they would be in other parts of what became Canada or the United States. By this, I mean that there wasn't necessarily a huge influx of settler population looking to farm in the traditional territory. And when it came to things even like the fur trade, Fort St. James, which is further south, was the more important fur trade post, particularly compared to McLeod Lake, which is older, or Fort Graham, which came much later. So, with regards to the impacts, it wasn't necessarily doing away with the foodways. It wasn't necessarily ending kind of the horticulture, agriculture, I was mentioning. The biggest change was the introduction of foreign food, if you want to use that terminology. So, one of the things that elders in Kwadacha talked about when I was doing some of my research, but also as a community member, was the introduction of flour. So the fur traders coming in, wanting furs, not particularly being that interested in changing the food ways and the sense of stopping things, but very interested in changing the food ways and getting people to actually purchase food from them. And the Hudson's Bay Company and other fur trade companies would actually talk about this in the records they've left behind, how they really wanted to encourage kind of this debt system where people would go into debt getting supplies from them. Then, in response to that, they would bring in furs to pay off that debt. So, kind of this endless cycle was the hope, arguably something that still exists to this day. But yeah, one of the big things with regards to food waste was getting people to, like flour, to like teas that aren't necessarily from this part of the world, but are being imported from other parts of the world, and other food items like that. And so, elders in Gwadacha talked about how when they were first given a bag of flour, and this would be not them, but people who preceded them after about hundreds of years, not being familiar with how to actually consume it, trying to eat it in its raw form, finding it to be quite disgusting in that form, and then throwing it on the fire, and then being very amused that when they threw it on the fire, it would flare up, which, something I would say is fairly common. People realize just how flammable flour is. But then the fur traders actually taking the time to show people how to make things like bread and bannock and stuff like that.
So one of the points you made in a recent presentation was that these changes affected all parts of your culture. Can you give us a few examples?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest ones was simply the introduction of that foreign food. In some instances, it might mean the reduced use of native food plants, items that actually exist. So people come to prefer things like bannock over other food substances like that. And it becomes kind of this prime mover in the sense that if people are wanting the food that's available from the fur traders, then they have an incentive to be involved in the fur trade itself in some way, shape, or form. So that was one of the biggest impacts kind of on day-to-day life. So it's food-based, but it is getting into what people are doing kind of as an economic activity in that sense. So that would probably be one of the biggest ones for my community. And related to that would be not only the introduction of foreign foods through the fur trade itself, but also through what you might call invasive species coming into the traditional territory, particularly with regards to various plants. So having those actually occupy a role in kind of the community's environment and with regards to harvesting overall.
I know there's different schools of thought about removing more invasive species. So what does that look like around reclaiming Indigenous foodways in the current state with our changed environment?
Yeah, I mean, it's a wicked question in the sense I don't think there's a simple answer. But I think with regards to reclaiming traditional food ways, a big part of it is just spreading the knowledge of what people used to eat in the past that maybe they don't eat anymore, how to harvest them, how to identify them. So that's one way of doing it that I think is really good. So just making people aware of it, having them actually consume those, or being aware that they can be consumed and how to actually properly consume them. The issue with invasive species, and I did say that some people would call them invasive species, is it is politically loaded terminology. And part of it is that we tend to view invasive species as negative, but we tend to ignore animals and plants that we see as positive who aren't necessarily native to an environment. So we don't necessarily lump them into that invasive species category. And a good example of that would be pigs. So, you know, we have pigs, they're not native to this hemisphere, but they're not necessarily considered an invasive species the same way that feral hogs are. And feral hogs are increasingly an issue that's coming into Canada out of the United States. But in essence, they are, you know, the same species. So there's that aspect comes into play. Realistically, I don't necessarily think that it's easy to simply remove all of the introduced plants or animals. There may be ways of actually reducing their presence, but I think complete removal, I don't know if that's necessarily possible. And then again, getting back to this idea that when we see something as beneficial, we don't see it as invasive. I also don't necessarily think that returning to traditional food ways means getting rid of everything that may have been introduced after, say, 1492. So a good example of that would be bannock. It's something that you know, a lot of Indigenous communities see as traditional food, although depending on the community, it might not have been something that they were producing prior to 1492. And then if they were producing bread prior to that point in time, it may have taken a different form than the bannock that is known today. So, but I think, you know, part of it is making people aware of what existed, but also recognizing that things can change over time.
The word that comes to mind, autonomy and sovereignty, and if people are aware, then they're also choosing how they want to eat and where they get that sourcing from, and it's not policing, even if we think it's better for them, versus we are trying to create debt. If we're policing people's choices and saying, well, no, you can no longer eat that because you were from a certain culture, that's still taking away autonomy and so sovereignty and isn't really celebrating traditional food ways anyhow.
Yeah, and it's important to point out, and I talk to my students about this a lot, about the Columbian Exchange. So just how many different plants and animals actually didn't exist in one hemisphere prior to 1492, and after 1492 did, and how that influenced traditional foods in general around the world. And kind of the easy ones to identify that most people are aware of, kind of from a Western Canadian perspective, would be things like Italian pasta. So tomatoes didn't exist in Europe prior to 1492, but a lot of Italian food, pasta, pizzas, tomatoes are, you know, ubiquitous. And there's actually an interesting history of how Europe came to accept that the tomato was actually something that could be consumed, wasn't dangerous, even though it was related to the nightshade. And similar situation with regards to South Asian food and chilies. So chilies didn't exist in the old world prior to 1492, but you'd be hard pressed today to find anyone who would consider South Asian food to be authentic if it lacked chilies. So there's this transformation that takes place. Again, getting back to what you're saying, it's about this autonomy, it's about this self-control, this ability to actually have power over what is actually happening, I think is important. Not necessarily the sense of resetting the clock to a certain date.
Something that we've been witnessing as we do these interviews is a remarkable, what I consider a loosening of the colonial grip. So I'm talking about patriarchal attitudes, mostly colonial attitudes. And I'm seeing it in small northern indigenous villages where communities are taking back their food sovereignty. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I have to a certain extent, but it gets complicated in the sense that the colonial grip may have been the weakest in the north. So it's kind of this question of where is the line between the two? And example of my own community is that we have reserves depending on the community, like McLeod Lake's part of Treaty 8, but they only signed on to Treaty 8 in 2000. When it came to Indian agents and things like that, there really wasn't a permanent presence in any of the communities that I've talked about. So, in a certain sense, the grip was light. So, this reclaiming is very interesting to see And it raises questions of whether or not it is connected to it being light in the first place, or if it's something that's far more complex than that.
You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot, agitating for change in Northern BC. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
In the first half of this episode, Dr. Daniel Sims gave us a quick history lesson on how food waste in his Sega Dene First Nation have evolved, both before contact and after settlers colonized the area around Prince George. Brenda and I felt we needed to better understand governance and food justice from a BC First Nations perspective. Up next, Daniel explains the impact these changes have had on how his nation lives and the many positive ways he and the Tseka Dene have chosen to adapt.
So I believe you're academic co-lead of the National Collaborative Center of Indigenous Health in Prince George. Okay. Well, maybe if you want to correct me on that, if you want to tell us a little bit more about that project and what it's looking to offer people. And you were mentioning like maybe this reclaiming that we're seeing in the north is also because the grip was lighter. What are you seeing? Because that's a national project. Do you get to compare notes across the nation about how that reclaiming might be happening differently?
I was co-lead with Dr. Sheila Blackstock of the National Collaborative Center for Indigenous Health. And I was in that position kind of an interim basis. So my predecessor, or our predecessor, Margaret Greenwood, became a senator and so no longer could be the head of the center. But my role was interim in the sense that they needed somebody to fill in the role before they did a full nationwide search for permanent replacement in that sense. But the center is one of six that exists in Canada. And they are actually independent research institutions that were funded by the Public Health Agency of Canada in the wake of SARS. So the SARS epidemic, and the whole point of the centers was to provide this institution, this organization that could actually help not necessarily conduct research, but facilitate research into various topics related to health in general. So the National Collaborative Center for Indigenous Health, their focus is looking at Indigenous health across Canada. And again, not necessarily doing their own research per se, but making sure that the research can take place in a good, fulsome way and that different people can be connected in different ways. So yeah, that was the kind of purpose of the center. I was really happy to be involved in it. So it was a great honor to actually be the academic co-lead of it. That being said, you have asked about kind of this nationwide perspective, and I've been involved in not only this project, I was also involved in a Canadian mountain assessment, which looked at mountains across Canada. It was part of the Canadian Mountain Network, and it was the first kind of assessment of mountains across Canada that had ever occurred. And I've also done a lot of work with Parks Canada. Regarding things like indigenization, reconciliation, decolonization. So a lot of different national organizations. So I'm going to kind of speak and answer your question based on those three, Canadian Mountain Network, Parks Canada, and the NCCH. I would say, yeah, generally you're seeing this loosening of a colonial control. One of the big challenges that exists in Canada is that we are such a large country that the Indigenous experience varies from location to location. So, you know, there's kind of the overall Canadian narrative of what happened, Canadian history. But when you start to go down and look at what's happening in individual communities, that's where things begin to really, I wouldn't say deviate, because I don't want to suggest that they're dramatically different, but there's different degrees of what occurred and what took place, different experiences that existed. And then it is further complicated by the fact that Canada is a federal system. So we have a federal government that is sovereign in certain areas. We have 10 provincial governments that are sovereign in certain areas. So even being, say, in Alberta or Saskatchewan or Manitoba can lead to differences compared to being in British Columbia. But I would say, yeah, overall, you do see this lessening taking place. You see this resurgence taking place. But it does become complicated by those local circumstances that exist. A good example of this with regards to my own community is that when they constructed the W.A.C. Bennett Dam, my nation was flooded out by the dam. And Indian Affairs, as it was known at the time, decided to create two new reserves by Mackenzie, B.C., Parsnip Number 5 and Tudor Creek Number 4. ultimately, most people in the nation didn't want to move on to those reserves. And indeed, I don't think anyone ever moved on to Tudu. A few people moved on to Parsnip, so the entire community relocated to Engenica. There had been a historic village there that's now underwater, but they relocated there. And so, because they relocated there against the wishes of the federal government and the provincial government, they had to basically take care of everything on their own, which meant that, there was no Hudson's Bay Company post there. There was no Northern Store post there. There was a trading post that was ultimately operated by my grandfather and then operated by the nation. So, for my community, we've had our own store since the 1980s. That brings a lot of benefits with regards to food sovereignty. So it's not necessarily the best store in the world in the sense that it doesn't have the widest selection. But yeah, since the 1980s, it's been owned by the nation. And prior to that, it was owned by an individual who was connected to the nation. So big benefit there. North of us, there's Gwadacha. And Gwadacha also had a store that was operated by an individual who was connected to the nation. But then ultimately, they would transform it into a northern store, which is connected to the Hudson's Bay Company, the Northwest Company. And then ultimately, they would take it back and turn it into their own store. So, even just that difference of location can change what occurs, what happens in that sense.
I was just thinking how fortunate you are that those things happened. I mean, that's serendipitous, but you have more control that way.
Yeah, it's incredibly beneficial. And even things like, so food is one thing. So having the ability to determine what is being ordered, what is being brought in. Technically, as a band member, it's my store in the sense that it's somewhat of a co-op in that sense. So even having the ability to say what I think should be brought in isn't always an option. But also with regards to things like consumer debt. So, I mean, we live in a world where a lot of stores offer consumer debt. But when it's different when it's the nation that's handling that than say a profit-driven corporation that has to make quarterly returns and make a profit in that sense. So yeah, there's those benefits that exist there.
I guess I'm curious about the what's next. We did frame it a little bit of for Indigenous leaders in the space. You mentioned three really interesting different areas you've gotten to work in. What's next for you? And being white settlers working in this space that are well-intentioned, but I sometimes worry that, yeah, I'm recreating dependent cycles rather than helping. So I'm just curious about your thoughts on what's next.
Well, I'd say, the one constant in life is change. So I was academic co-lead at the National Collaborating Center for Indigenous Health. I'm not anymore, but I'm still involved in a number of different health-related projects at UNBC, but also in Canada in general. Same is true with regards to Canadian Mountain Network. So we produced the report. It was published a few years ago, but still do research with regards to mountains and the environment, local, but also regional, provincial, and national domain. And then the same is true with regards to parks. So I was a member of the Indigenous Cultural Heritage Advisory Council. And that council came to an end this spring, but then I joined the Indigenous Heritage Circle, sub-circle, looking at cultural heritage. So, I mean, things change, but the work continues. And I would say it's a really interesting time in the world in general. And that can be seen as good, that can be seen as bad. But I think one of the challenges that Canada is facing is one kind of proving that it is actually serious about reconciliation, serious about UNDRIP, serious about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, all of the different other commissions in plain sight, missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. So that's one of the challenges that's currently being faced. But I would say it's interesting too, because the other challenge that I see increasingly coming up is kind of what I refer to as going in depth when it comes to Indigenous knowledge. And part of it is recognizing that Indigenous people do have a right to self-determination. Part of it is recognizing this means that different Indigenous groups, or potentially different groups within a single group, depending on how you want to look at it, may have differing visions with regards to what's actually occurring. So I think that's one of the big things that's really kind of occupying my attention right now. I think, for example, yesterday, I think it was, the Manitoba Métis Federation announced that they weren't going to meet with the Prime Minister because the Prime Minister wanted to meet with different Métis organizations in Canada. And they don't support a number of the different organizations that exist in Canada. So it creates this interesting situation where, in a certain sense, the federal government's meeting with Métis people. In another sense, they're getting involved into larger questions regarding what it means to be Métis and who actually speaks for the Métis in general. And I think this is going to be something that'll be seen with regards to food and foodways. So what does it actually mean to be Indigenous? What kind of foods can be brought back? What kind of foods can be kind of kept if they're newer foods? And just larger conversations regarding, health and food in general, particularly with regards to differences that might exist between different communities or different environments, but also in the face of climate change. So what does that mean? What does that represent? I know a number of communities in British Columbia, including my own, have actually asked the question of what does climate change mean for the traditional territory? And it's related to things like economic development, things that are being proposed with regards to trying to deal with climate change or prevent some of the worst disasters from occurring, but even things like just as simple as food. So what does it mean if the climate changes and the plants that you are used to having in the traditional territory that you are currently harvesting, you might harvest in the future, are just no longer there because the environment has changed? And the same goes with regards to the animals. So what happens if the animals have moved or are no longer available because of climate change?
It's very impactful, though, on how people live. Their whole survival mode changes. We're watching the salmon stocks decline dramatically right now in Wet'suwet'en territory, and we're all very concerned about the pipeline's impact and what that will mean to their food sovereignty.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a good example of it, right? The salmon fisheries have been, I don't want to say decimated because I do know decimated does have a specific terminology, reduced by 10% in that sense. But we have seen the salmon stocks negatively impacted over the years in British Columbia and around the world. And for those communities that are dependent on the salmon or have been dependent on the salmon, it raises some rather interesting questions regarding how they're going to deal with this decline, or how are dealing with this decline, and what happens if it declines even further. I do a lot of work on the prairies, and that's something that a lot of prairies First Nations have been dealing with for over 100 years. What do you do now that the buffalo have been more or less eradicated? There are still some herds that exist, but if your traditional way of life was based on the buffalo, how do you make sure the buffalo continue to have that role, or do you decide that you need to change certain aspects of your culture or somewhere in between?
This podcast was generously funded by the Public Health Association of BC. Brenda Barrett is my co-lead and the executive director of the Storytellers Society in Hazelton. Technical production by me, Christine Bruce. Music by Elijah Larson. Our food expert today was Dr. Daniel Sims, associate professor at UNBC and a proud member of the Tsekatine First Nation. For more information on this or any other episode of Tempest in a Stockpot, visit storytellerssociety.org/tempest. Thank you for sharing this meal with us. I'm Christine Bruce, reminding you to stir that internal pot and consider how your Indigenous neighbors have been affected by our shared history. We are all connected, and our foodways are deeply intertwined and profoundly affected by the land, by community, and by politics.